In these turbulent financial times, securing your investments with gold and silver needs to be done today, before the next crash. Go to republicmonetary.com for our free information kit.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Oh, there. Now we wanted to make sure we didn't have connection. We got rain here. When rain happens in Phoenix, everything breaks down because everything's set for not rain. Well, we're glad to have you here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Jet Lacy. One thing that we wanted to go over today is we're going to go ahead and make sure that we touch on Obama's speech last night because, we have to. And the one thing that I want to do is make sure that we go over the predictions that Jet and I made yesterday. Yesterday afternoon, I also had Adam Kokesh on for a little bit because there's some news that Gary Johnson, the governor, former governor of New Mexico, is going to run for president in 2012. And there's an effort to get the revolutionaries to be supportive of his campaign. And it's always good to have libertarian-oriented kind of in the drug war, let's get back to Austrian economic kind of guy in there. You know, that's good. You know, bring the boy on. Let's talk. But that's not what they want. The bad guys are of the opinion that the revolution that surrounded Dr. Paul's campaign somehow is controllable or is a package. There's a suitcase full of votes and support and money and whatever out there that if they could find the handle, they'll try and get hold of it. I knew this would happen. That is why I did everything I could to make certain that there was no handle. Nobody controls a logo. Nobody has a group, an organization. I mean, the closest it would come would be something like a Campaign for Liberty, but that's Dr. Paul's thing. I mean, what are you going to do? Go to Campaign for Liberty and say, I want you to come over here and help do whatever? I'm sure there's deals and attempts and stuff that's going on doing that very thing. But my being approached was there was a group of Republicans yesterday that came together. I don't know if Gary Johnson was here. I got the impression that he was. I got called by someone that was prominent in the Republican Party and had connections to the Ron Paul effort. And Ernie, we want to bring you in, man. You and your army. Just the fact that they would even say that means they have no freaking clue what they're talking about. Not a clue. They don't get it. They don't understand what is really going on out here. People of free mind are not going to be helping and or focusing on or doing anything other than whatever it was that motivated them in the first place. Dr. Paul made it very clear what that was. Freedom. Are they for that? Well, then they'll get the support and they don't need me. But that's not how they operate. It's all deception. It's all theater. It's all listen to what I say, not what I do. Well, we'll see. I mean, if he does good things, Gary Johnson will get support. Cool. Well, I got, you know, Judge Napolitano and him and Ron Paul up there. I like having those kind of choices. But, you know, that's what we saw last night with Obama. Presentation, we'll talk about in a little bit.
There are those that just want to be left alone. And those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Well, don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Don't worry, be happy.
Yeah, don't worry, be happy here on Declare Your Independence. With me, Ernest Hancock, Jet Lacy in on the board, and Jim Kaiser in there working away, trying to be quiet, except during the breaks. Now, the thing that we're doing is we're going to go over the speech a little bit from a different perspective. I mean, you know, you kind of look at something, you know, here I want you to see. There was a British newspaper, I think it was, that did this. They took State of the Union addresses, and they put all of the speech into of each speech all the way back to Lincoln and FDR and JFK and LBJ and Reagan and Bush and Obama, and they took the words and they go, which ones did they use the most? Okay, now I was interested in this because Jet brought this up yesterday. He goes on the last show, he goes, you know, they check the words that Obama uses, and what's the one he uses the most?
I, me, mine.
You know, and that's what he did this time. 76 times, I. But, I mean, he's in good company. I mean, you know, FDR did it, 24 times. JFK said the word I 39 times. That was number one in his speech, too. And but George Washington used it 11 times. It was number three behind which and will. I'm not even sure which, why that was so important. And then Abraham Lincoln, 63 times he said I. Let's see, LBJ, 57 times, Reagan, 37 times, George Bush, 34 times, ooh, and Barack Obama blazes them all with 76 times, he says I. Well, you know, I don't care how many times he says I, as long as he says, I will not mess with you, he does that. But, you know, the other thing that was interesting is the word freedom. I can't even find it on here. I don't even think he said it. And it sure as heck isn't in the top. I mean, it's in single digits if it's anywhere. I don't even see it. Did he even say freedom one time? I'm going, liberties? Yeah, that's not in his vocabulary, okay? So we talked about what was it that he would say about several things. And this is one thing that we brought up. Healthcare, war, Fed, IRS, government work projects, food, housing, tea parties, gay rights in the military is what Kokesh said yesterday afternoon. He goes, you watch. That's going to be a big thing with him. And he just kind of threw it out there. You know, that's his, you know, kind of throwing a bone to the progressives and the gay community or whatever. And it didn't even really address it. He just said, you know, we're going to reexamine it or something. And that's how he put it. He goes, now, who you love doesn't matter in the service of your country, something like that. I mean, he just kind of, you know, is one of those just itty-bitty baby things. Well, this is the one thing that I wanted to keep track of. And you're talking to Kokesh, we only had like 45 minutes, and the guy wanted to talk about all kinds of other stuff, so we never really got to the list. So I only got about four or five out of him because he had so much to say about a lot of different things. So, of course, he'd go on, and we didn't get to everything. Healthcare. Now, Jet said, you know, it'll be bipartisan thing. I agreed. You know, it's going to be a bipartisan thing. Okay, bipartisan thing. And that's pretty much what came out. We are so close. We are so close. We're a skoosh. We're hairs away from having a we rule you health care. And, you know, and what is it that the government wants to control? Anything that sustains your life. I got the federal, not just state. I mean, you know, states got their own problems. But, I mean, you know, on a federal level from Washington, D.C., I got them controlling over what? Whatever medicine, anything I put in my body. My freaking body, okay? Any kind of herb, drug, medicine, food. You don't think so? Yeah? Try and sell some eggs. You know, so that, or raw milk. Heck, just giving it to your neighbor. You know, this is so anything that will sustain your life, they want control over. So here it comes, healthcare, big, giant, major, national. Here we go. They are so close Well, we have Scott Brown. He gets in, takes over liberal Massachusetts U.S. Senator seat that was held by Ted Kennedy forever. And, oh, man, health care is dead. National health care, yeah, we win. Yay, conservatives, Republicans in 24 hours. Within 24 hours, Scott Brown, okay, now that campaign mode is over. He actually said that. He goes, now that we're out of the campaign mode, you know, we can talk about getting health care for everybody. Yay.
Then Ernie, I felt that his whole speech was a campaign speech. I thought it was all hope and change. He was a shucking and a jiving. He wanted everybody to get back on the hope and change wagon so bad.
Well, was that a Freudian slip, hope and chain?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe a little bit. I don't know. Sorry.
This is, you know, the one thing that on the healthcare deal, I look at these speeches and I really avoid them as much as I can. And when I'm in radio, especially, you know, like Charles and I, we used to argue over who gets to watch it. Okay. Who has it? Because we'd have to take cuts of it and we would play a lot of the little cuts and everything. And I'm not going to bore you because it was just, it doesn't mean anything. You know, I've seen, it's like, I look at this. That's why it's interesting on the word thing here where they did the comparison. I go over probably my adult lifetime. And when I go back and research other speeches, like Jimmy Carter's malaise speech, you know, crisis in conscience and or confidence or whatever it was, that really was a good speech. It was just that way he gave it. It was so slow. And I did it. You know, I have it on my computer somewhere. I'm going to do that show one time. I did it for a show, and I just never did it. I took out all the pauses. I didn't edit a single word. Just took out all the pauses so that it just, you know, it reads better. And that's a kick-butt speech. And Carter, all he was saying, he was going, why are you always looking to government all the time? You know, we have to, you know, be our own blah, blah, blah. So that malaise speech, that wasn't a State of the Union speech, but it was really a pretty good speech. I didn't have a problem with it. He was basically going, man, you quit looking at me to fix this stuff for you. Get off your butt. So it depends. You look at the words, and you can see Reagan was always really good at inspiring people to do their own. I'm just going to get out of your way. But then, you know, Daddy Bush was VP and Cheney and Rumsfeld, all these guys are in, you know, they just did what they wanted anyway. So the one thing that I notice when you watch these, and if you know anything about what's really going on, if you're covering it every day, you're on the radio, you're doing news coverage, you're Freedom's Phoenix, that kind of stuff, they'll say something, but you know what he really means. You know what really happened. He's going, we cut taxes for the, and he rattled off all these tax cuts that he did. Well, not really. I mean, he did, but it was part of the stimulus package where they got $700-something billion that he did last February. And they go, here, we're gonna take away this tax. We'll do all this little stuff, a little bitty tax cuts here and everything as part of the package that we're going to pass. And, oh, we're going to indebt your kids another almost $1 trillion to give you this little, you know, not only are we indebting you a bunch more and taking a bunch of money, we're going to make it even worse later and have to drag this out and interest more and everything by giving you these little tax cuts. So we can say we did. We gave you a tax cut as part of a stimulus program, which really to each family didn't come to hardly nothing. But that wasn't the point. It was so that in this State of the Union address, they could say, we gave a tax cut to the middle class, blah, 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 while we robbed them of $700-something billion. So they forgot to tell you that part, okay? So where are all these tax cut things he's talking? And I'm sitting there, I'm going, you know, how deceptive is that? They're going to take 700 whatever billion dollars from the American taxpayer. My granddaughter, she's still in the womb. All of a sudden, boom, got a big giant rock put in her backpack, and she's not going to have to pay as much for that muffler, okay? You know, so I'm going, okay, you know, if that's how you're going to do it. And then you look in the audience and you see there's, and all of these, the media, when they cover these, the television crews, they get the speech in advance. You know, they know. I mean, I probably even says, standing ovation here, 473 times, you know. So what happens is they go like this. They go, all right, they know in the pan and they go to someone. You know, it's like when he was talking about the bailout and AIG or something like that. He mentioned, you know, the bailout back in the day. Boom, they put it on Geithner. And I'm going, yeah, he just got his butt kicked earlier in the day, you know, in Congress. They were slapping him around or something.
He looked pained, too. He really did. His eyebrows were all furrowed together, and he was looking really pained.
You know, I tell you what's interesting, Jet. I had, because I'm going on a trip tomorrow. I'll be gone for a week. You know, Jet and Thomas and Kelton and the boys, and they'll all, you know, keep you entertained. I guarantee they're... A lot of people, they get more mail than I do anyway. So they have more fun. But what happens is my daughter-in-law brought over Kaylee, my granddaughter, just so I could, you know, see her and everything, get all filled up on my granddaughter before I left. Well, I had to explain this. Here's a, you know, 22-year-old young woman has no clue of what all this stuff is about. Doesn't know the people. I mean, she kind of gets, you know, she's hanging around, a little philosophical understanding, but she doesn't know who each of these individual people are. So I'm positing it as they're walking them in, showing all these different people. Let me tell you the story behind each of them.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Beetle? Yeah, I, you know, and yeah, whatever. But you know, one thing that's interesting, I mean, go through this chart. Well, I'll post this on today's, during the break, I'll get, or yeah, we'll get it up there on today's archive where you'll see this chart, or we'll make a PDF of it and you can refer to it because it's a Google Doc. Now, State of the Union addresses, keywords, and they took and compared all the words in the speeches. Like when you got George Bush, you know, at least he used the word freedom 14 times. You know, let's go Ronald Reagan. I mean, I guess they're probably blending all of his together. And I don't see it in the top up here. But he, you know, at least we got, I'm sure, once. I mean, you know, a couple of times. But the thing is that I can't find the word freedom or liberty one single time in Barack's speech. You'd think he'd do it just by accident. And, you know, it goes to tell you that when whoever writes these speeches, I mean, of course, you know, he's standing there practicing it, you know, 400 times in a mirror, I'm sure, but that they would, you know, by accident use the word freedom of something. But it tells you in their mindset, it's not even there. At least Bush, you know, he knew that he was supposed to say it, whether he believed in it or not. You know, now we got people up there smiling that freedom. Well, that just sounds so ew. I mean, they have to almost intentionally avoid it. So I'm going, okay, you know, this is what we're dealing with. Freedom, liberty. You say, okay, we may use liberty. So I'll look for liberty. Nope. You know, self-determination, free will, you know, nope. Okay. You know, I get it. You know, this is, So my thing is that we are up against a philosophy. When you look at, I had to explain to my daughter-in-law all the people involved. You know, I'm going, okay, there's Rahm Emanuel. Let me tell you his story. There's Janet Napolitano. You know, let me tell you her story. Let me tell you this guy's story, this son's story. And that was another thing. There was something, somebody got some props because Madam Speaker, the President of the United States. And it's usually one guy that does that. And they just have one guy come in. Well, this time they had two guys. You know, Madam Speaker. And then the other guy goes, the President of the United States. So they wanted to spread it out to something. I don't know. Big deal. But it just, you know, set in a little different tone. Okay, you know, we're not following tradition from the beginning. All right, fine. Not that I care, you know. But he goes down. He's shaking hands with people. And we recorded it, had dinner. And then we can fast forward through the, you know, blah, 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 blah. We didn't fast forward through any of the speech, although I felt I could. It was when you have the crowd shots. Now, you know, when does the entire Congress stand up? Yay, golf clap. When do you have just the Democrats and then the Republicans will sit down? When do you, and then when they did something about small business tax cuts and the businessman and small and this, that, and he's blah, 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 the Republicans didn't stand for that. And he goes, well, I thought I'd get a little more applause on that one, you know. Well, why don't they? Well, it's because it doesn't serve their interest in whatever way. But the thing is that they already know the truth about all of the words coming. That is not to the Congress. That is campaigning to the people. And that's what Reagan did. You know, Reagan's really good at that. You know, Clinton did the same thing. You know, one thing I was surprised that Obama didn't do more. And the most you got out of it was, yeah, Haiti and the generosity of the people and so on. You have the ambassador of the United States from Haiti up there sitting behind the first lady, and they'll go to him real quick, and he wakes up from, you know, his nap, and he's like, oh, yeah, you know, thanks, and so on. And by accident, sometimes they get, you know, senators yawning and stuff like that. You know, that's whatever. But I don't think Dr. Paul goes to any of these. I talked to him about before. I go, do you ever go? He goes, heck no. I'd be the only congressman left after. they go after them, man. You know, I'd be the only one left. But he just knows. He says, no, I don't. You know, because it's a stand up, sit down, stand up, sit down, stand up, sit down, applause, clap. He's just so knows better. And you can tell in the faces when they go to the people there, you know, talking and so on. But I had the same response. He'll say something about something, and they know he's full of crap. It's just, they're just, I mean, you can say it with a straight face. I'll give you an example. On the war, what'd he say? All troops coming home. I mean, didn't he say that, Jet? I mean, I remember him saying that.
Oh, yeah, that was his campaign promise. But then he said that one time or two times. But in reality, he did say, oh, we'll get him out of there in 12 months, 18 months, blah, blah, blah. I kept lengthening it. I'm sorry. He just never kept really any of his promises.
He was talking about, it's something about the Afghan people have to stand up. We got to get the Afghans to, you know, take over. And that, you know, I've been through this. It's called Vietnamization, you know, Afghanization. It's a, you know, we're going to send more people over there so that we can have more people teaching them that they don't need more people or something. Then today on Slate, it's probably up on Freedom's Phoenix by now. I sent it to be put up. Let's see if it's here. It was Afghanistan is asking for what? Afghanistan says they're going to need Western help for 15 more years. Well, who's, you know, and then it's, you know, declare, this is one thing that was kind of an interesting thing that Rand Paul said something about, you know, if we're going to be in Afghanistan, we need to have a declaration of war. And I'm going, against who? They're our guy. I'm not even sure. This is so complicated. It's so messed up. You know, who are you even declaring war against? And the same thing. Now we're working with Yemeni military and so on to keep our puppet there, too. Bring them home. Bring them home.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Ernest Hancock in Phoenix, Arizona, from the beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com. And all throughout the day, we'll be putting up more and more response of the coverage. You know, the thing is that we have our own opinion. And, you know, I'm sure there'll be a lot of writers that'll have something up there. Powell may have something to say. I have something to say. We all got something to say. And there's a lot of people that have something to say. And a lot of times that we'll just let all, you know, from all different perspectives, it'll get up there, the left, right, this, that, and the fact check. And then you kind of get the idea on your own. But I'm telling you this. There is a common theme that comes from all of the left, right, let me tell you the one thing they are not going to challenge. And we talked about this yesterday. Would he address the war? You know, Jet says something real threat. What were you talking about that real threat on the war? Do you remember?
I'm sorry?
On the war, when Obama was talking, we talked about it yesterday, and I got down here, I just made a note, real threat. If there was a, on the.
Well, the real threat of Islamo-fascists. And he never did use that word.
Yeah, you thought he was going for Giuliani's money?
Yeah, I don't know. We talked about that yesterday, about whether he would use Islamo-fascists or not.
You know, and I said, I didn't think that he was going to attack Islam, you know, because that's he's trying to, you know, keep that down to a minimum, you know, being as he's a brother. And so what happens is I go, well, I don't think that that'll come up, but will he you know, there are threats out there. They're coming after us. So he didn't really address the war much other than, yes, I sent more to Afghanistan. Yes, we're going to have to, you know, Vietnamization of Afghanistan kind of deal. But the only thing he really addressed on the war that really stuck was they're coming home.
Well, yeah, he did say a lot of things, though, that were, I don't know, I thought that were a little bit more than that. And he said that, looking through my notes here, that our greatest source of strength has been our ideals. The same is true at home.
Yeah.
You know, there's all kinds of things. My thing I really wanted to talk about, and I was looking for it, I'm printing out a text of the speech last night, but he said what I thought was the most interesting, and, you know, me and Drew Phillips, we got our mind right to get, you know, to watch the speech last night, so we watched it as sort of a comedy event, but the thing was that really made my jaw drop is he said he was going to create a bipartisan fiscal commission, and earlier that day, yesterday, the Senate blocked a bill to create it, and so he wrote an executive order creating the commission anyway.
And how many Goldman Sachs guys are on that one?
I don't know. It's a bipartisan, you know, congressional thing.
Of course it is. Let me tell you, it's going to be a one-partisan Goldman Sachs thing or Federal Reserve thing. I can guarantee you that.
But I think it just goes to speak a long way to the fact that he doesn't even care. This is all about he is a Caesar. He doesn't care that the Senate doesn't want this to go through. He only cares that he wants to get it done, so he just overrode them.
You know, what's interesting is when you look back in history when they do something like this, it was just posturing by the senators, knowing he was going to do it anyway, gave them the ability to vote it down and get the sanction from their money supporter guys on Wall Street and whatever, knowing Obama was going to do it anyway. You know, this is how the game is played. I guarantee you, in the end, they get exactly, oh, I'll go four times, exactly what they want. How they do all this, you know, manipulation of the press and politicking and election year and all that stuff, he's going to get what he wants. Because the first thing out of his mouth when he started, you know, right off the bat, it was, I hated the bailout. Everybody hated the bailout. You hated the bailout. People hated the bailout. We all hated the bailout. So much we did it anyway. So, I'm going, and what's that homage to? You know, the Tea Party guys or something? So we were talking about, any mention of the Tea Party? Well, you said, nope, no mention. You're right on that one. And I said a reference to it, and I'm saying that was their reference. Oh, everybody hated the bailout, okay? So I'm saying that's where that came. The Fed, you know, Kokesh said he's going to avoid it. You said, more power to the Fed. And I think, you know, I don't remember if there was a specific phrase that he had that he's going to, you know, more power. I guess this commission thing is, you know, kind of eking that way. IRS, nope. Government work projects, yep. Here we go. We're going to be a modern society built by the government. Your mic's not on. Hey, your mic's not on.
He said, we all hated the bank bailout. I hated it. You hated it. It was just about as popular as a root canal.
So everybody's like, ha, 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 ha. He gets it. He's one of us. He hates it, too. You know, playing like a violin.
You know, this is just theater, and this is and Drew and I were talking last night that we can't believe that we believed in, you know, our government for so much of our lives. That we believed when they gave the State of the Union address that it was a real and heartfelt speech.
You know, like it was a State of the Union. It might as well have been campaign election year. In fact, with Bush, it was, okay? And anybody else, he's doing the same thing. Then we hear Hillary Clinton is going on saying that she won't go for a second term, okay? If he wins a second term, you know, she's not going to go into the second term. She'll teach and write. Right. Now, she'd always wanted to be president of these United States of America. So, you know, this is, you know, Hillary isn't done. Then, let's see, food.
I think that was the smartest thing that he did for when he became president was to give her Secretary of State. Because, A, then he was her boss. B, she got out of the Senate. And C, he could fire her at any moment. I thought that was so smart.
He did. I mean, he did whatever he could to get her in there, too. Promised her all kinds of stuff. And, you know, that we'll deal with Bill and don't worry about it. So, yeah, you know, I think it needed to be done. She got whatever it was she wanted, she got, I guess. Man, she got to travel around the world. And she represents the United States and other countries. I'm going, okay, if you're going to do it bad, you might as well do it really bad so that, you know, everybody knows it's a joke. The food. You know, did he, you know, expand on this? He didn't really tie. He's talking about jobs and jobs and jobs and jobs and housing and jobs. But, you know, the one thing that he did is he said it was something about limiting foreclosures. You know, we're going to do it. And you were talking about that, you know, that they're going to start allowing you to foreclose, but you get to rent the home from it being returned back to the governor, Fannie or Freddie.
Right, because they were just nationalized. So then the government, on top of being owning all those properties, they will then be able to collect money off of the rent.
Yeah, I see socialized housing coming. But see, they already have. A lot of people don't know. If you're poor, they call it Section 8. Section 8 housing is, I lived, you know, I was poor, okay? In the early 90s, my family, we lived in a triplex. We had like two units. One was like an office and one was where we lived. And we paid our own way. But around us, all around us, it was, you know, a lot of poor people. And the area that we went in, I'll tell you this so you understand. In the late 80s, when the savings and loan thing hit here, and we had a business, we had a mobile auto detailing, a laundry service, and we were expanding, and we had a service, and it was called Motivity Services. And it was something, a concept I had when I was a young man, and I built up this business for, and we still have clients. But the thing is that, you know, we were rocking and rolling and whatnot. I was, you know, we're providing for ourselves. I saw the crash coming when a lot of my clients that I did their BMW, you know, on a regular basis, their big Mercedes, all this, all of a sudden they were having me detail it for the last time to sell it. I mean, it was a wave. All these people, like, yeah, Renee, you should come detail my car. I got to sell. I'm like, what the? I put my head up. I'm like, what the hell is going on? It was a savings and loan thing was collapsing. So I'm going, oh. So I saw the signs from the ground up back then, and I see the same things now, even before. I saw it when the dot-com bubble went, when I had my restaurant. And I'm going, oh, I see what's going on here. All these big $400 or $500 orders for lunch we'd have all the time for these large IT groups that are building web pages for De La whatever. All of a sudden, they're going away. And then, you know, the housing bubble and so on, and then we sold the restaurant in early 03. So then, you know, my wife really started focusing on her real estate, and then we just got – so we got from the ground up. We've seen before this stuff happened. We lead it. Her brother, my brother-in-law, is one of the rating guys at Moody's. So you can imagine conversations. But he and I'm going, look, I'll tell you. I will tell you when I think it's going to go. And I don't give a crap what all your forms and everything and reports and government BS says. I will tell you when it's going to go, and you watch what happens. I called him one time. It was right before the dot-com thing really hit. It was like 2099, whatever. And I go, here it comes. And the reason I knew is because we had pizza delivery also. And whenever, because I was with Domino's back when I was a young man, I, you know, managed Domino's, opened franchises in the 80s and new corporate stores around. That's what I did. And what happened was whenever the economy was taking a dump, you got floods of driver applications, because that guy that bought that new little Honda Accord, you know, sitting at home watching primetime television wasn't, you know, enjoyable anymore when he couldn't make his bills. So you part-time job of your wife goes away, you start losing income. To make ends meet and to be able to sustain your standard of living, you're spending at least 3 hours during dinner delivering pizzas. Fine, that's when you need them. And they had to have a car that was in good working order. They had to, you know, pass, like, you know, they take baths and stuff and got most of their teeth. I mean, you know, drivers had to have insurance on their cars. I mean, because they couldn't be homeless guys out there doing it. So what would happen is we'd get floods of applications for pizza drivers. Well, that started happening in the late 90s. And I just got, you couldn't beg for drivers. And I mean, it goes 6 months before you get one application. I'm having all my friends, hey, just come and help on Friday, you know, 3 hours. That's all I need. All my libertarian friends, they come. We'd have, you know, a pizza party afterwards, a big rush, dinner rush and so on. I mean, whatever I could to get people to drive, and we'd have fun. You know, that's how I only got to see him when I was running a restaurant for 5 years, is, you know, during that. And we'd have parties and whatever to have meetings there and so on so that I get to maintain contact with my friends. They made a little extra money, helped me out. A lot of them worked a little bit more, worked on the weekends. Then all of a sudden, boom, big, giant increase in driver applications. So I go to my brother and I say, here it comes. You watch. And he goes, and he surprised me by saying, you know what, Ernie, you're probably right. I've been talking to some of my other friends. Another friend that he had was a manager of a truck stop in upstate New York. And he goes, the drivers are all complaining that they got half loads. They're not backed up 6 weeks anymore, knowing that they got a job. Now they don't even know where their next load's coming from, this kind of stuff. So there are real life in down in the gutter where the actual, or on the street at least, where the actual economy is seen and felt, and you get preludes, you get advance warning of what's coming. Whether if you pay attention and you get old enough and you're in business, you're in the economy, you benefit from being able to pay the rent on your facility or the business that you operate, or you deal with the public, you see it. Well, here it comes. Real estate, same thing. Went through that in the early 90s. We took that opportunity and got small. I said, look, we're not going to survive this unless we lower our bill. So we moved in from our house. We got out of the house. We went and we rented a small place, and we went to where we thought we were safe. And it was a poor area called Sunny Slope here that used to be where a lot of people came, moved here because they had, you know, lung issues and breathing and whatever, and go to Arizona before it became, you know, Midwest and planting all the plants and everything down here. It used to be desert. So we lived in this area that was dominated heavily by Caucasian bikers. Okay. This was an area to where lots of tattoos, lots of Harleys, but it was safe because they all had guns. You know, none need apply. We got it taken care of. So we felt safe up there, even though it was a poor area. As long as you're a decent person and you go, there wasn't, you know, a lot of drug dealing or any of that kind of stuff. They were just, you know, that culture. And we lived there for 9.5 years, raising our 4 kids. Everything's fine. Then Section 8 came. Section 8 is subsidized housing. And when they started doing that, all of a sudden, all the welfare recipients, all the people, you know, they may not have made much money, but they made money before. They worked for a living. They just wanted to, you know, I don't know, drink it away at the biker bar or something. I mean, you know, I had no problem. I felt safe there for years. And then Section 8 came. With Section 8 housing, it was a big political issue in my area there when I started getting involved in politics. All the local merchants called the Sunny Slope Village Alliance, the businessmen there were freaking out about this because they had, you know, slumlords and so on would come in and buy these little triplexes and little apartment buildings and everything under the whole intention that it was going to be government housing. And all they had to do was nothing. I mean, you know, they just collected the rent from the government, you know, basically, and these guys all got to live there, and it drove the prices down more, so they bought more, and they got, so then finally, and we, of course, we moved, but I'm going, you know, I see how public housing affects people, and it doesn't, it's not a benefit to society. And it's not a benefit to the individuals. It makes them dependent. It reinforces bad behavior. It subsidizes it. So I'm going, okay, housing, that's where I see this is going. It's going to be continued more dependency government housing and the lost generations of welfare and housing projects and all that kind of stuff. They haven't learned their lesson. There is no philosophy that's going to save them or going to make it better. They just want people not to riot. They just, you know, feed them, put them in a tent.
Seems like we're going from the nanny state to the orphan state. You know, a bunch of homeless orphans that don't have anywhere to go because everything's tanking. And then, you know, so they have to take care of us, but it's at the very bare minimum in order to control us and keep us down.
And you want to get more of something, you subsidize it. Mm-hmm. That's how it works. Because if you subsidize, I'll give you an example. This is a perfect example. If you reward good behavior, you get more of it. If you punish bad behavior, you get less of it. What does social collectivism kind of do? The exact opposite. They punish you. He's talking about if you're making over $250,000, if you're doing it, you're getting taxed. We can't afford it anymore. Just get used to it. You're getting taxed. There's going to increase taxes, $250,000 tax. Under that, okay, well, we're not going to increase your taxes. Heck, we're going to give you all kinds of stuff. So what's going to happen? You are going to increase, you're going to reward poverty and punish productivity. Bad, bad, bad idea. because it more of it is coming. But he did say he supported gay rights in the military, so I guess he's got some progressives on his side. What about the rest of them? We'll talk about it when we come back.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence. With me, Ernest Hancock, and Jet Lacy on the board. We're talking about Obama's State of the Union speech and what was and was not said and what was and was not told. The truth. You know, the one thing I want to go through the list here real quick. The Tea Party, well, he didn't, of course he didn't mention it. He's kind of alluded to that when it came to We Hate the Bailout. That was the only kind of homage he gave to that. So I guess on our list here that we went through, we all pretty much covered it. I think the only thing that he didn't talk about that I expected him to was more on food and housing. You know, just people not, you know, I know he's going, we have green shoots. Green shoots. You know, we saved it. Green shoots. And, but I know there's people out there still suffering and all that kind of stuff. You know, for every good story, there's a bad story. And I'm going, yeah, for every good story, there's like 20 bad stories. So it was, you know, there was really no substance. The only things that I remember that had any impact on anything that you could see what's coming here real quick is that healthcare, we're so close. We're so close. So they're going to, yeah, here it comes. The war, he didn't really talk about anything, you know, the threats of this, that, whatever. Troops coming home. Troops going to be coming home after we increased Afghanistan, after we did, we're going to Vietnamize the Afghanis. Because that was the same project that they talked about back in LBJ and Nixon's day. We are going to turn it over to them. Well, they had to send more people to turn it over to them. So we're going to train the Afghanis. Well, you've seen on Freedom's Phoenix, we've had some video of these soldiers that are over there, and all the people that they send them to train are the young men, lazy, dope-smoking, hash-addicted scumbag that they kicked out of their village. They
I have never been to Afghanistan.
Okay, yeah, give me a second. Yeah, you're kicked out of the village. Anyway, so what they did is they send them all these guys, and they go, you know, this is you, these are the people that's going to defend this country or make it a nation, because you can't. They are not oriented that way. They are tribes. They're like this land, you know, this border you guys put around Afghanistan that is, it was made up by Western world anyway. He goes, we don't even know what the hell you're talking about. You see that mountain range there? From there to there, that's my house right there. That's my home. This is mine. And then you ship me on the other side of that range and say I'm supposed to go protect these guys. Heck, I've been at war with them for 3,000 years. You know, whatever. So I'm just going, it's just Western thinking trying to go into a tribal culture that's trying to tell them how they're supposed to live. No wonder the Afghan says we're going to need you for at least another 15 years with eight. What does that come to? 23 years? Holy yeah. crap.
And it's that's just why, like we were going to get out of Korea.
Well, that was what Bush said. I remember what Bush said. Bush was saying a 20-year war on terror. Well, he knew why. He needed a generation of, you know, mind-screwing these guys to get them, you know, just to forget whatever it was before. As we got little kids, you go to the airport, and 20-something-year-old parents are telling their 3-4-year-old kid, take your shoes off and prostrate yourself against the wall for the man. You know, this is the kind of stuff that's happened. It's a psyop. So can you beat that out of a culture? Well, they tried. And in Iran, it backfired. Okay? Here comes Ayatollahs, and they said, oh, we ain't playing no more. Well, they got to get Iran back in the box. They for whatever reason, because Iran is a very old Persian culture that has their own kind of identity, and they have their own defined area, their own language, their own, you know, it's Iran. You know, and they got, like, what, 60 million people or something? They're not going to be pushed over. Of course, you know, Israel just wants to nuke them.
I mean, look at the movie 300. It was the Persians that, you know, Leonidas and the Spartans were fighting. I mean, they've been around a long time.
That's right. And I don't think you're going to make their empire any smaller. It's not an empire now. It's just, you know, it's our country. This is where we're at. We're good. We'll stay right here. Now we come back. You know, Jet made some good points about what did he say about 9/11? Now, he was chastising the Supreme Court there a little bit, too. What was that about? Well, when we come back, we'll find out here on Declare Your Independence in just a little bit.